Session number 14983, Albert Shippen, reel 13.
Mr. Shippen, reel 13, you were talking about the difficulties which the battalion was going through in Greece.
Yes, well, as I say, the reduction in manpower was getting at acute stage in that time. And, I mean, if you can just appreciate how they worked it out. I joined the army as a boy in 1941, and here we are in 1946, people have been released, and although I was a regular soldier, because of me service and everything and that, I'd been given a demob group number. Now my number was 46. Now you can just imagine that I had no overseas points or anything to get. The number of people that had served from 1939 to 45, and it got points for overseas, being prisoners of war and that, these people were taken demob. And the other factor that we've got to consider is that people were going to go out to give a hypothetical kind of an answer on this. People would say we're going out in group 46. Well, they were leaving the battalion something like about a month to 2 months beforehand to be able to be in the United Kingdom to go off to York or wherever it was, to the demob centres, to go out on the release dates. So, and there was no reinforcements coming out. But yet, all these jobs had to still be carried out. Even if the division wasn't functional as a full division, it still had its headquarters and its hospitals and its supply depots and all that, and ammunition and this kind of thing, all had to be looked after. And with the revolution being going on between the Greeks and this kind of thing, they were guarded more than any else. I did hear stories. And I was approached personally one night. I was on the Ordnance Vehicle Park guard down in St Lonigan. And the sentry shouted, "Guard Commander," and I went out. And he says, "The Greek wants to talk to you by the wire." And I said, "Right, officer." So I said, "Well, cover me while I go and talk to him." And I called the 2IC, the guard, out and said to him, "The sentry's going to cover us, come across here, there's a Greek wants to talk to us." Now this Greek spoke very good English, and the conversation went something like this: "If I would switch off the perimeter lights down in the certain section where these big scammels were parked up and other vehicles, they wanted to take the wheels and tyres and that off them. And this kind of thing, they would come through the wire as if they broke in and everything that." And he said to me that he had a sandbag which he produced. We could see on the perimeter wire lighting that he did have a sandbag, and he said that was it was half full of British gold sovereigns which had been dropped to the communists during the war to enable them to fight against the Germans, and that if I would let them go in and cannibalise some of the vehicles and that, I'd get my reward out of that sandbag.
Did the Greeks attempt to break in?
Well, not the night I was in, but oh yes, eventually, yes, oh yes. Thieving was a real business, and I mean parking up your vehicle in the town and this kind of thing was a real hazard. You had to leave someone there, or you'd come back and the wheels had gone, or the vehicle had gone, or this kind of thing. It was definitely a very high-profiled item on the list, transport, definitely. Because, you see, they didn't have any factories, or they didn't have anything, and the Germans had moved out with their equipment, what they left behind, we took in, put into compounds and so forth and this kind of thing. And being up in the northern Macedonia in the mountains and all this kind of thing, it was all donkeys moving about, or it was walking with huge packs on the backs, and this kind of thing. And of course, they couldn't move the vegetables or whatever they're growing, the grapes and the figs and the melons and all this kind of stuff around to without the transport. And of course, there's no such things as buying tires. You couldn't slip into a tire factory and say, put us a tire on. It was all cannibalizing. I mean, vehicles didn't look like vehicles at all.
If you lost tires or a vehicle this way, was that an offence in the army's eyes?
Oh yes. One of the chaps that came out with me to the 1st Battalion, a lad called Joe Dooland, who was a regular, he was a corporal in charge of the docks down in Salonika. And during his tour of duties, the Greeks got into the docks by some means or other and stole a vehicle. Drove straight through the crash barrier and everything like that with a vehicle. Now he was he went through all the procedures of the army command officer and everything like that, and was recommended for summary of evidence, which then was sent forward to a brigade whether they were going to court-martial you or not. He got court-martialed. One of the officers that I'd mentioned beforehand, Cyril Alder, I think he spent most of his time defending people on court-martials or summary of evidence and that while he was with the battalion. He actually got this corporal off because the army said that the vehicle number, which had been stolen, was one number. And the defending officer had checked with army vehicle records and said, well, where is this vehicle at? And the signal came back, well, it's certainly not in the Middle East as far as they were concerned. So when the court-martial convened, the defending officer said, I'd like to put this to the court that there's no chance to answer. Here is a signal from the army vehicle records thing with the number concerned, and it's not in the Middle East. So he was immediately admonished, and that was the end of it. But there again, you see, that chap he wouldn't re-enlist when his time came to re-enlist, because although I was a regular doing 9 and 3, a lot of these guys were on 7 and 5, and some of them even were on 3 and 5. So when the 3 years were up, they just went out onto this situation. But this was the stupidity of it all. I suppose politically, looking back at it now, Churchill wanted the King of the Hellenes put him back on the throne because of the communist threat through Bulgaria and this kind of thing. Our military presence there was probably, to use the terminology we use today, to show the flag. But we were doing nothing, but it was demoralising to everyone because we were just sitting on our tails and doing nothing of any great significance. And getting ourselves with boredom in the bother, and it wasn't what the army promised them to be. We were sitting about waiting for things to happen and guarding ourselves, which wasn't a very enthusiastic part of anyone's life, was it?
So it affected morale and discipline in the battalion?
Oh yes, tremendously so, yes. I don't think... And of course the other thing about it was, at that time we had a lot of people which were being released from prisons in the Middle East, and that they were being sentenced to and this kind of thing. And they were pulling the units like ours to reinforce them and this kind of thing. And if they behaved themselves, they came... we had Lovett scouts and all sorts attached to us at that time, people who had been in prison and that. And it was more or less, if you did 6 months good service or something like that, your sentence was squashed. And of course, these guys had been in prison for striking officers or losing equipment or all sorts of kinds of discipline. Relating to the army, but wouldn't relate to your civilian life. And of course, they were also looking for their demob number to get home, and that some of them had been out there for quite some considerable time. That was it. And then, of course, the one of the big factors was about that time as well. I know from the experience of my stepbrother, he had been in the 1st Battalion. Pre-war and served in China and the Sudan and this kind of thing, and was taken a prisoner with Wavell's 30,000 and been in a prisoner of war camp in Germany till the end of the war. And of course, that was him. He didn't want the army anymore. And there must have been hundreds of people like that that had that experience, and that finished her off. And so the army at that stage was very, very depleted.
Other than bartering, which you've mentioned, did the men get involved in purloining things and giving them to the Greeks for something? Was the thievery going on in that way?
Well, petrol obviously was a big thing, and there was quite a number of people court-martialed for selling petrol. I would think that the main traffic in that was... people involved in transportation, which would give you a lot of rewards, and also the other side of it was people that ran canteens, soap and all this kind of matches and so forth, and just everyday, you know, toothpaste, razor blades. Everyday things that you took for granted yourself was done. There was one particular case you've just brought to my mind about it. Was the chap who ran the the 4th Division Dutch cheese canteen in Salonika. He was due for demob and everything like that, and the next thing that he knew, that I was escorting him back. To a court martial for embezzlement and all sorts of things. He thought he got away with it. He made his pile out of selling whiskey and the things that chocolate and all this kind of thing. The troops had been doing fiddles and that with the Greeks and what they wanted and that. And he was just about to be demobbed when he was taken into custody, and I was his escort on his court-martial. Another one that I was very prominent with, we had a colour sergeant in the battalion called Norman Watt. Nice chap. And as I say, the difference from Salonika and Exandi was two different worlds, and he got himself mixed up with a girl called Effie, who was his lived not far away from the paddocks we had in Salonika. And he got himself into serious bother with her by giving her a revolver. And he was under escort in the battalion, being a senior rank. And I spent days and days and days as his escort and everything. And in the end, he got court-martialed. And was found guilty, and was sent off to the military prison in Gaza, in Palestine, as it was not known in those days. Another occasion, a very sad occasion, we were the Greek muleteers, which they came through our camp, and their camp was above us, where they had these mules and that, and they used to take them up into the mountains and carry equipment and all this down for the Greek Royalist Army. And we had a young driver, for some unknown reason, was coming through the camp, and it had, he tailed onto the end of one of these Greek mule convoys coming through. And for some unknown reason, the mules at the rear where his vehicle was were startled and panicked and ran amok. And it was quite a tragic thing because I think, if my memory serves me right, there was about 7 Greeks killed with these mules taken off at a very fast rate of knots up this very narrow road that we had in between the two camps, and this kind of thing. And he got court-martialed, and he was sent off to Gaza as well. But practically everybody that went on to the petrol pump filling station in the barracks, the majority of them got court-martialed as well, because I think probably the rewards were too great that they couldn't turn them down. And if they were using gold sovereigns, which was apparently, I mean, my own experience, I never saw them, but this is what they say they were bartering with. It was quite a temptation. But I just told the guy that offered to me, I said, "Oh, if you don't go, I won't give you the gold sovereign. I'll give you a piece of left lead in your left ear."
It's quite a while since on the tape, but you were talking about your own problem in front of the commanding officer and mentioning that RSM had spoke up for you. What did happen?
Oh, well, the commanding officer was a commanding officer, proper gentleman and an officer. They called him Colonel Kirby, John Kirby, and his nickname amongst the lads was Honest John. He was a fanatic of playing cricket. Do you play cricket? If you played cricket, well, you were one of his men. He was a fanatic at cross-country running, and you went out cross-country running, and if you didn't beat him in, because he'd been the prisoner of war, in fact, my stepbrother was his batman in the prison camp. They were both taken together in the desert. And so you can imagine he was getting on quite a bit. And he was quite a gentleman. And he looked up at me and he said, "Well, if that's the case," then he said, "we can't have you falling asleep, can we?" So he turned out the RSM and said, "Try and give him an extra night in bed now and again." And I got admonished, which meant I'd had a telling off.
You must have been worried about it, though. It's quite a serious offence to sleep on duty.
Well, the thing about it is, I suppose at the end of the day, at that time, as the RSM remarked, that and so did the company commander who was present when I was there, that the duties were just falling on you that fast that you didn't, you couldn't do anything else. I mean, it was natural for you to want a certain amount of sleep, and you weren't getting that amount of sleep because you were active as a senior NCO. You were looking after your platoon and this kind of thing. They were tired, and morale was low. Food wasn't too good. The accommodation wasn't spectacular. The rate of exchange was something like about 32,000 drachma to the pound. So you can just imagine what state the economy was in. This revolution thing was going on. And that was it. Yeah, it was a I suppose if you were in an active unit and you fell asleep at the time and everything like that, yeah, it would be a serious offence. But when you consider that, you know, they knew that they could go around the majority of these places and find people asleep all the time. I think it was just, we had all these duties that to do, and I think it was a matter of showing the flag that the Greeks knew there was someone there. But that again, as I say, we weren't getting the reinforcements in. People were going out and on the mob. People were reluctant to sign in on. And the withdrawal of units out of the 4th Division to other places and that. And we got the short straw by being left in Salonika.
Were you getting mail regularly?
Oh yes, the mail wasn't too bad because it used to come up mostly as I said before, we had a big Mediterranean fleet, and I remember that some of our supplies used to come up on a cruiser called the Leander. What few supplies we did, but it brought in the mail quite often, and of course aircraft were flying in. The Dakota was coming in quite regular from the Middle East headquarters in Cairo and this kind of thing. But that wasn't too bad, the mail side of it and this kind. In fact, we were quite privileged because Greece was well known for its sponges and its currants and raisins, which were still in short supply in the United Kingdom. And we used to send packets of raisins and currants back home to the UK, and also sponges. So it was a two-way traffic. The mail wasn't too bad.
Was the mail helpful in the sense that it helped your time there, or did it cause some problems because of being told about home and people wanting to get home? Was that making it worse?
Well, I think the majority of the chaps in the unit at the time, I would think they were so brushed off and cheesed off about the whole affair that this kind of thing, that they just wanted to get home. But personally, I don't think it affected me as being a regular soldier and this kind of thing. And I know a friend of mine, and this story might bring you a laugh to you. Andy was a bugler, and we were in Salonika together, and one day I went into the billet where he was sitting, and I said to him, "Hello, Alan, how's the world treating you?" And he says, "Oh, not too bad." And I looked down, and he had some metal polish, Brussels. And he was rubbing it into this saw on his arm. He says, "What the dick are you doing?" Oh, he says, I'm sick of this lot. He says, I'm going to get a return to UK. And he was literally feeding his rash on his arm, with his metal polish, and reporting sick, and saying it was a kind of a sweat rash, and that, and they were giving him all sorts of treatment, and of course he wasn't doing the treatment. He was pouring his damn metal polish onto the damn thing, and he eventually got sent home, on a right, absolute, you know, a great friend of mine. And he was a regular, and this kind, and that's the kind of attitude they were taking.
You've mentioned your battalion commander and your company commander, and one or two of the other officers. What are your memories of the people you were serving with? Fellow NCOs, any outstanding ones at that time?
Well, we had a quartermaster called George Flanagan, and he'd been an RSM and everything like that, and very dogmatic chap, and absolutely ruthless in this kind of thing. And he actually, believe it or not, eventually we met up many, many years later and become quite good friends. But at the time when I was a sergeant and he was the quartermaster, never the twain shall meet. I had a story one day, the battalion sick parade, obviously, and I was a battalion orderly sergeant, and used to take all the the sick men to the MI room, and they had to have the small packs and that with them, and this kind of sick report. And the medical officer then used to say, well, he go into hospital, he go this, that, and the other. And you took the sick reports then back down to battalion headquarters. Anyway, this day in question, there's quite a number of men on sick, and he was coming past the quartermaster. So I smartly stood to attention, gave him a nice smart salute and everything like that. And as he returned his salute to me, he said, you report to my office when you've finished this duty, Sergeant Shippen. I said, yes, sir. So I immediately went down to his office, and his RQMS, who was a chap who'd served loyal service in this kind of thing, called Benny Calvert, and was the regimental quartermaster sergeant. I said, sir, the quartermaster said, I have to report to him after I'd finished my duty at the MI room. Yes, he said, and he gave me battalion standing orders. And in the battalion standing orders book, there was a part flagged which said, paying compliments to officers. So the RQMS informed the quartermaster that I was there. The quartermaster said, right, and marched in, saluted, stood rigidly to attention there. And he said, have you got battalion standing orders with you? I said, yes, sir. He says, right, open it at the page which is flagged. He says, now start reading. And it was paying compliments to officers. How you pay compliments to officers? And this kind of thing. And he come to the part where it said something like, you know, the senior person will bring the body of the men to attention, and he will salute and then stand the body at ease after the man had passed. So he said to me, why didn't you carry out that instruction this morning? I said, well, sir, the men were sick. And his reply to me was, when we want a new medical officer, we won't ask you to take the position. And he kept me reading that paragraph over and over again until after about 4 or 5 minutes, he said, right, I hope that has sunk into your thick skull, and don't let me ever see you not paying compliments as laid down in battalion standing orders. And for that, I got another 2 battalion orderly sergeants.
He had a war record, of course.
Oh, brilliant war record, yes. Yes, he was... He, in fact, he went... He was in China with my stepbrother, not in with John Kirby, the colonel, and he went right up through. He was on Kos and Leos, and he rode across to Turkey. He got away. He was interned in Turkey, and then when they formed up this 1st Battalion again, in a place called Mime in the Middle East, he was RSM, and then he eventually got made quartermaster, and he went right the way through, and he finished, he went to Korea with the 1st Battalion.